Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and I've just got a quick announcement to make before we start this week's show. I'm going to be talking about my American road trip this coming Monday, the 19th of November, at Skeptics in the Pub at the Monarch Bar on Chalk Farm Road in Camden. It starts at 7:30. Please do come along and say hello and buy me a drink or something. It would be great to see some of you there. So on to this week's show. Our guest tonight is Johnny Hughes. Johnny Hughes is a filmmaker in the BBC Natural History Unit and head of development for BBC Earth. His documentaries have been shown on the BBC, Discovery and National Geographic Channel. He studied ecology and evolution at the University of Leeds. Johnny's first book is On the Origin of Teepees, Why Some Ideas Spread While Others Go Extinct, and that's what we talk about on tonight's show. So I'm talking to Johnny Hughes. Johnny, thank you for joining Little Atoms today.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
So we're going to be talking about your book On the Origin of Teepees, Why Some Ideas Spread While Others Go Extinct. In this book, you take a road trip across the American Midwest and you take a look at the history of some ideas, but through a very sort of specific filter. So perhaps tell us what the central idea behind the book is, first of all.
Okay, well, I'm entertaining an idea that's been bubbling around for quite some time, but is becoming increasingly popular with academics and other people alike. And it's the idea that human culture evolves very similar to animals and plants, that cultural evolution is very similar in all sorts of ways to biological evolution. The idea that ideas themselves, the parts of culture that we sort of hang on to and pass on to others, are in some senses alive from a Darwinian perspective. And I think there's this parallel, this ability to use Darwin's logic on not only biological evolution but cultural evolution that's interesting. It's great fun to adopt that perspective and see where it takes you.
Before we go in to talk about the ideas, just give us a brief rundown as to where you went on the trip. As listeners will know, I did my own American road trip earlier in the year, so it'd be great to hear where you actually went.
Okay, well, we started out, I went with my brother, who's sort of nothing to do with this topic. He's just a great kind of road trip partner. And we flew over to Minneapolis in Minnesota, which is the sort of gateway to the Great Plains. And we drove out through the Dakotas and Wyoming and Montana up to the Rockies, and then even ventured up to Calgary in Canada. So we went over the breadth of the Great Plains, and the point of that was that we were en route to visit the Indians, the Great Plains Indian tribes.
You'd already got the route planned out with this topic in mind, rather than this sort of evolving as you went along the trip, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, there was a certain investigative angle to it, so we were happy to change our plans as things became apparent. But the aim was to head out. I mean, we went to Minneapolis because it's the biggest airport in the area, so we just flew in from Heathrow and then hired a Chrysler and headed off west, into the Wild West, and went where the investigation took us. But we knew roughly what was going to happen. There was one event that we were heading for. There's an event in Montana on the Crow Indian Reservation called they call it the Teepee Capital of the World. It's the sort of World Teepee Festival. That was our aim to head there.
And indeed, you describe that event in the book.
Yeah, no, it's a fantastic place. I mean, you're in a pop-up village, a bit like Glastonbury, but everything's pointed. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of teepees, and they're authentic teepees because they're owned by Plains Indian families. So, you know, they're the real thing.
So we'll get back to the teepees in a while. But first of all, the book, as you said, it takes the ideas of Darwin and looks at culture through that perspective. And at the beginning of the book, there's a little primer on evolution, and I'd like you to talk about that for a moment, because there's a really interesting analogy that you use which I hadn't really come across before, and I'll get you to explain it. But basically, you talk about it through the old joke about how the chicken crossed the road.
Yeah, there's one way of looking at all the creatures under the sun. You can divide them up into four different categories, and it's as follows. The first category, they're nicknamed the Darwinian creatures, and those creatures try and tackle the problems of life in the most brutal sense, really. Some of them are born with, just by luck, really, with the right equipment, the right behaviours, the right technologies even, the right sort of sense organs, etc. And they can take on life by birth, if you like. They have a birthright and they succeed in particular environments. So Darwinian creatures are the simplest creatures out there that you can imagine. And I talked about a jellyfish is nothing more than a couple of tissues sort of loosely strapped together and called an organism. So the question was, how did the jellyfish cross the road, jellyfish can't cross roads because they're not, well, unless they're flooded, which does happen. But, in my imaginary scenario, how does a jellyfish cross the road? Well, it does it by luck. It's all pre-programmed. They follow fully instinctive lives. And if they happen to be the sort of jellyfish that can navigate the traffic, then they're lucky and they'll go on to have the next generation of jellyfish. If they're not, then they die. And that's why it's Darwinian, because it's all about survival of the fittest, and it's pretty brutal. The sort of next tier up, the Skinnerian creatures. Skinnerian comes after B.F. Skinner, who is famous for his work on conditioning. And these creatures are a little bit more savvy, I suppose you'd call them. They don't have to be too sophisticated. In fact, the example I give is a sea slug. So something, they're not much nouse, but they've got an added advantage on the jellyfish in that they can learn from experiences. So if you poke, no listeners should do this because it's very cruel, but if you poke the gills of a sea slug, they will at first withdraw their gills because they think that they're being eaten by a fish, I suppose. Tuck them away because they're very valuable things to a sea slug, can't survive without them. But if you continue to poke them when they fan out again and there's no kind of nasty consequence of this poking, the sea slug will actually learn not to bother retracting its gills. So it's benefiting from a little bit of experience, I suppose. And that built-in capacity is part of conditioning. It's what Skinner spent a lot of his life sort of looking at. So those creatures, they cross the road, they encounter, they sort of solve any problem that Earth throws at them, with the benefit of also being able to experience and learn from experiences. So it's a step up. The third tier are the Popperian creatures, and that's after Karl Popper. And Karl Popper is the guy who came up with the scientific method and basically said that you should come up with a hypothesis, a sort of idea, and that you should test that idea. And your hypothesis, he said, would die in your stead. So these are creatures that are so smart that they can come up with a plan because they've got a little model of the world in their heads. So they might look at a busy road and actually have some sort of cognitive whirring and think to themselves, well, I'm going to go to at this point because there's fewer cars or cars slow down here, etc., and come up with a plan, and then go across it. And Popperian is quite advanced, actually, but we do know that even things like chickens, the chicken that's crossing the road, has got a capacity to come up with a plan and use a sort of internal model of the world to get a better-than-chance outcome from any kind of challenge. We've got all those capacities. We have instincts that allow us to do kind of Darwinian behaviours, and good luck with that. We've got plenty of capacity to learn from experience, so we've got Skinnerian intelligence, if you like, and then we've also got fantastic models of the world in our heads that we spend years and years building as kids. I suppose we build them throughout our lives. And we spend a lot of time referring to those and coming up with plans and solutions to things. Any one of us putting together IKEA furniture would have had a good bout of that. Because we never look at the instructions, do we? We always try and put it together just using our Popperian intelligence. But we've got something else as well. And the top tier of this tower of, in fact, it comes from Daniel Dennett, who's a philosopher over in America, and he calls it a tower of generate and test. The top tier, I've called, after him, the Denisian intelligence level. And that, instead of chancing your luck because of your genes, or learning, which could be a painful experience on a road, or having to go to the effort of thinking things through, we've got the capacity, unlike virtually any other creature on the planet, to do something totally different. We can actually cross the road successfully without having to apply any of those kinds of intelligences. Because what we can do is we can shout across the road to someone who's already done the crossing and ask them, what's the best way of doing this? And they might say, well, go to the top of a hill where all the cars have to slow down, or do it at night time when there's less traffic. And so we've got the power of inheriting information on solving the problems of Earth from another member of our species without any use of the genes. I mean, we all pass on information to our offspring through genes, but non-genetic information passing, that's a very, very special capacity indeed, and we have it in spades.
And all of these things, this knowledge, but also cultural artefacts and trends and fashions and things, all of these things, all of these ideas exist in a world of ideas. People will be familiar, listening to the show, will be familiar with the meme theory. But you introduce another concept here, which is something called the noosphere, which is another term I've not come across before. So tell me what the distinction of that is.
Yeah, so if we look at the world and think of it as a body, you know, how can we describe it? Victorians and even people before that in the 18th century were, the early scientists, were trying to look at the world and think of the best way to describe it. And they came up with great titles like the lithosphere, meaning all rocks, meaning all kind of stone, anything solid really. The hydrosphere, meaning any form of liquid from ice to rain to the oceans. And then, of course, later on, around the time of Darwin's On the Origin of Species, we came up with the biosphere. So the idea of it's the totality of all living stuff on the planet. And of course we have the atmosphere as well above us. In the early part of the last century, a Russian philosopher talked about the noosphere. And the noosphere comes from the Greek nous, which is nous, which is to do with knowledge. It was an imagined sphere which was trying to sum up the totality of all human ideas. So every bit of information, every fact, every idea, even every opinion, I suppose, every sort of approach to something. The whole of culture, in all of our brains, and all recorded history, that's the noosphere. It's this enormous realm in which everything a human species has ever thought resides.
I want to move us into some of the examples you look at in the book. We'll look at an example of a cultural artifact being invented. You look at the example of the cowboy hat.
Yeah.
You describe three different ways in which the cowboy hat may have been invented. So let's talk about the first two, first of all. Describe the first two, first of all, because the third one is the most interesting and perhaps controversial one.
Okay, yeah, sure. So if we have this new perspective, and we're gathering together a kit of parts here to look at the world in a new way. So we're saying perhaps the whole of human culture has got a sort of Darwinian evolution going on at the heart. Maybe ideas, and as you say, skills, jokes, facts, anything, could be vulnerable to natural selection and living in a certain way. And then we've got this description of the world in which this all happens, the noosphere being this big cultural realm in which this adaptation, sort of adapt or die, survival of the fittest logic applies. It makes you look at the evolution of any cultural item in a different way. And so a great example is, as you say, the evolution of the cowboy hat, which I was coming across regularly. We're in the Wild West, so of course you see cowboy hats, but actually as you drift west, you see more and more and more. They're sort of, it's a species of hat that appears more frequently as you go onto the Great Plains and certainly up to the Rockies. They certainly like it up there. And so I looked at the history of it. And if you take a sort of glance at the history, you surf the Wikipedia page, it was the same thing. What you'll get is the sort of classic history of who invented the cowboy hat. That's, if you like, answer one to the question of who invented the cowboy hat. And it's what any cowboy will tell you, it was John B. Stetson. John Badison Stetson invented the cowboy hat. And the Stetson is the most famous cowboy hat we all know, one of the movies. And certainly there's a lot of, you know, there's a history to support some of those ideas. We know that Stetson was the son of a hatter on the East Coast, and he went to the West to make his fortune in a gold rush in Colorado in the 1860s. And as he was there, looking around, there was no kind of bespoke headgear for the Wild West. And the Wild West is a tough place to live. Very hot, it's got a lot of sun on you, a lot of rain on you, a lot of wind on you. You're very exposed. It's wild. And these guys were digging for gold with ridiculous things like silk top hats and sort of horrible flea-bitten raccoon hats, which were homemade, and then a few people coming out from the south with very wide-brimmed sombreros that they couldn't get on their horse with. And there were a lot of borrowed millinery, but nothing which was perfect to the Wild West. So Stetson, the story goes, invented the cowboy hat on the spot by the rivers that he was panning for gold in, and he beat rabbit fur until it was waterproof, and he made it wide-brimmed, but not as wide as a sombrero, because that was impractical, and you didn't need it, because you were further north, and with a tall crown to keep your head cool, so it could sort of lose heat. But it was a combination of all the little attributes, all the traits. So if you wanted to create a hat that was perfect for the environment, then Stetson managed to do it. That's answer A. Answer B is that it wasn't Stetson that invented the cowboy hat, it was the cowboys. Because as market forces work, unless a load of cowboys took up and ran with this idea of Stetson's, you'd never get the hat passed down through history, if you like. It wouldn't have been a success. It just died. So it's kind of like saying there is a selection process, just like Darwin talked about, but it's a market forces one, it's an economic one. And there's plenty of capitalists to be sort of familiar with that idea, that it was the cowboys making those decisions that picked Stetson's hat and ran with it. In fact, when you look at the market of hats, of headgear, the history of it all back in the 1860s, 1870s, early 80s, what you'll see is that Stetson did release a hat onto the market, but it didn't look anything like a cowboy hat that we know today. It was actually pretty boring looking. It was kind of like a bowler hat. They used to call them derbies out there. But it was like a bowler hat with a wide brim. So it just had a nice smooth dome on the top. You see them in some of the old photographs of the Wild West. And that went onto the market. It was a new thing. Fair enough, it looked new. It was a new fashion. It took off because they were very expensive. So when you had one, it was like a status symbol. But because they were so expensive, the cowboys could only ever own one. And they wore them out for 10 years out there in Texas and Montana and beat them smithereens, basically. So they ended up with dents in the crown. They had little dimples and they had rolled brims because they kept on grabbing them to hit the cattle with, etc., or sleep on them, or yee-haw, or whatever they do. And you end up with a hat with lots and lots of different physical attributes from the one that Stetson ever imagined. Now, they became the sort of iconic hat of the true cowboys who were out there with the cattle year in, year out, and the market responded. Not only Stetson's, but also rival hat makers responded and put dents in their crowns and rolled brims, etc. And certainly we know that, and you can find it today even, if you really know your cowboy hats, you can tell where a cowboy comes from based on his hat because they have slightly different styles in different states. So there's a sort of evolution going on there, but you'd say it was market-driven, created by the cowboys themselves. The third response, answer C, to the question, who invented the cowboy hat, is no one. that no one person, not even a group of people, consciously invented the cowboy hat. That, like a hell of a lot of other cultural items, what's actually happened is that, 100,000 cowboys have been engaged in the changes that have occurred on this cultural item. And none of them have had any conscious participation. None of them have actually said, I need to move, if you like, the direction of this cowboy hat, the future of cowboy hats. I need to be part of that. So what they've done is they walked into a shop, and my brother and I watched a couple of cowboys doing this, actually. They walk into a shop, they look at a bank of different cowboy hats. They're all slightly different. There's variation going on there, as Darwin would say. And they pick one, after a lot of milling about. And the reason they pick one could be all sorts of things. It could be that they look like their dads. It could be that they thought about it and they thought, I need a wide brim because I need to keep the sun out of my eyes and they work best. It could be that they say, well, that's the hat that my rodeo hero wears and I want that. There could be a whole load of different reasons why one cowboy picks one cowboy hat. I think the point of answer C, is that none of those reasons matter at all. Mm-hmm. Actually, doesn't matter the reason by which that cowboy hat was picked. It's the fact that it's picked. Because when it's picked, they sell better, the shopkeeper orders more, and then you get this evolution of the cowboy shape, colour, etc., over the years, but none of the reasons behind that actually matter.
So that's it's an example of natural selection in action.
It is, because you could ask the question about any creature out there. Mm-hmm. Lions. What do lions look like they are today? Why do they act like they are today? Well, it's an accident of history, actually. You've got something that evolved for different times, different environments, different habitats, different prey, and over the years, we're talking millions of years, these creatures change over time, and the descendants, the things that we see around today, the things in the zoo and on safari, they are restrained by the journey of their ancestors. There was no conscious decision-making going on, if you believe in Darwinian evolution, that lions have descended over millions of years from ancestors. There's no choice going on there. It's just happened.
Now, obviously, a lot of people don't believe in Darwinian evolution. They would cite God as being the cause of these things. And I guess the God in our example here is our old concept of the lone genius. Where does this leave the concept of the genius? The Stetson, or the Edison, or I guess we can even talk about the Darwin. And obviously, Darwin was building on the work of Erasmus Darwin, and the Alfred Russel Wallace was obviously coming up with the idea at the same time, so I guess this isn't a particularly good example, Darwin, but he's still the person that becomes the man behind the idea.
Yeah, it does rather pull the rug away, this whole approach, that what you're saying is, in the case of cowboy hat, as an example idea, if you like, that there's no genius there to find. It's actually a cooperative effort, mm-hmm. and largely subconscious, largely automatic, largely happenstance, fitting in a particular environment, which includes not only the environment of the Wild West, the actual climate, but also the environment of social environment of cowboys and their various aesthetic values and all these sorts of things. Very complex kind of environment in which to evolve. Yeah, so the question is, well, where does that leave us? Are we not smart enough to actually come up with new ideas ourselves? And I think it's quite a complicated one, and it took me a while to wrangle it, actually, because I'm just like you. I'd love to give Darwin credit for a really great idea. And so, because I'm biased, I suppose. And so you're looking for an angle in which human genius can survive. Not great to be told that, we can't have any genius, we can't have any conscious part in cultural evolution, which we feel that we host and own and are party to. So I had a good bit of thinking about this, and I think there is a place for genius, actually, in the classic sense of the word, because what you've got to look at is not the brains and the people that are hosting the ideas, but actually the ideas themselves. And as I say, if they're going down, if a single idea is going through the generations, with each generation, evolution is acting on it, if you like. The environment is selecting the best versions of that idea, and it's passing down through generations, and it's changing over the years, just like the cowboy hat did. Well, if we take the idea of evolution by natural selection, we know for a fact that from records and from photographs and from accounts that, and his autobiography as well, that Darwin spent 30 years thinking about that idea. And what he did was he'd traditionally walk around, a little walk in his house, down house, and every time he went around the lap of his, it was a circular walk, every time he went around, he'd kick a stone to one side just to keep account of how many laps he was doing it. He said he was doing it for health reasons because he was a sick man, but actually what he was doing was he was spending time thinking. And the reason he was kicking a stone is because he didn't want to have to count. He didn't want to have to keep something else in his head. He wanted to just think about this problem being the idea of evolution by natural selection. He spent 30 years doing that. Now, during that time, we know from notebooks that the idea went through scores and scores of generations, that it went from very primitive, kind of wrong stuff, through lots and lots of very particular scrutiny. He was chucking away the versions of that idea that didn't work, if you like, in his own internal environment, his own territory inside his head, that was putting all of these ideas under the microscope, and he kept the ones that did work, or the ones that worked better than the previous generation, and he put them through the same sort of level of scrutiny. And we could see that this is the creative process. Everyone does this. You know, we're all there designing new clothes, or we're there coming up with new technological solutions, either individually or as groups. And I'd say that that process, where you're advancing through the generations of an idea, you're changing an idea, I'd say that's a great version of genius. That's genius at work. Again, whether it's solo genius or the genius of a small group of people.
I want to look at another example that you talk about in the book, and this is a good one because it shows us both this cultural artifact being created by individual people but also being enacted on by the physical environment that it's in. And this is, as you drive across the country, you notice the change in shape of barns across the landscape.
Yeah, for any Brits driving across the world, well, the Great Plains, the barns are really noticeable because they are huge, and they are, well, one of them are red, and they've got white doors, and they've got little sort of chimneys on the top, which actually I discovered are for ventilation. The most striking thing about all of them is that they've got these roofs that are, they're called gambrel roof, gambrel after the leg shape of a horse, apparently, and they are bent so that they have a very steep side flank to them, and then there's a bend in the roof, so you have a double pitch, and then you have a more shallow rise to the peak, to the apex itself. And when Adam and I first saw these, we were cast back to our childhood, because we used to have a little barn like that as a Fisher-Price barn to play with when we were kids. And it was red, and it had the same gambrel roof. And back then, we just thought it was a crazy kind of barn that someone had invented at Fisher-Price, because you never see those. You never see a barn that shape in the southwest of England, which is where we were being brought up. You have different sorts of barns here. But over in America, they're all that shape. And so we started thinking, well, you know, where did that come from? Why don't they build just English barns like we see them, stone ones, sort of long ones, the traditional ones that we see at home. And started looking into it, and the American barn, again, if you look at the history book, was designed by geniuses who were going west. They were claiming land because it was a big open space. There was a land grab on. And as the farmers went further and further west, they tended to have more and more land because it wasn't as good quality, and also it was tougher land, so the stakes were bigger. And they all had larger plots, which meant they had larger farms, which meant they had more cattle or more cereal to collect, which means they needed a bigger barn. And as you go west, you actually get this incredible evolution happening in front of your eyes, where you're seeing younger and younger barns as you go further west, because the farms are younger and bigger. And what you notice is that every single barn you pass, because it's hand-built, is slightly different. And, you know, looking at the history of this and talking to some historians and archaeologists of American history, and we know this anyway because we've seen it in the films, when a barn is created, there's a great sort of community event where everyone gets together and they raise a barn. They get all the tools they can possibly get together and all the equipment they can get together, and they all help each other because no one person can build something so big. And it kind of explains why everyone is different. Because if you think about that, you've got a whole lot of people who are putting up something, and it's never going to turn out the same twice. You're going to have either a slightly different spread of tools or a slightly different spread of materials that year, or you're going to have a slightly different land shape, a sort of footprint to put it down on. There might be a slightly different requirement. Maybe the barn needs to be built in a certain way, have a few more chimneys on the top, or have a slightly larger attic, or whatever it would be. And because they were bespoke, no two are the same. So there's variation in there. Now, variation is the first ingredient of natural selection. You need variation. You can't have a whole species of clones for natural selection to work. It's got to have variation of fitness to pick the fittest. They're all equal fit, then it won't work. So variation is really important, and that parallel in culture is really obvious for anything that's not machine made.
Let's move on to teepees then. The title of the book is On the Origin of Teepees. If listeners haven't noticed yet, there's a fantastic pun on the origin of species in that title. So let's have a brief look at the history of what happened to the Plains Indians and how that may have impacted the movement of them, for instance, you know, how that may have impacted on the development of the teepee design.
Yeah, again, heading into Minneapolis, I really didn't know my history of Plains Indians. It was part of the investigation. I wanted to find it out as I went along. I wanted to hear it from them as well and learn a lot about it en route. It's an incredible history, but it's not half as ancient as you might imagine, actually. The Great Plains, out of all of the habitats in America, are kind of the suckiest, really. They're the last place you'd want to live because it's brutal up there. It's cold, and there's not much food around. There were lots of buffalo, but no longer. But there's not much food around up there, really. And it would be a much nicer place to live in the woodlands, even on the mountains, where there's berries and fruit. Certainly by the coast is always a good place to live, and the lowlands. So, you know, the Great Plains, kind of what's left over once Indian tribes have settled everywhere else. And certainly, what we now know, again from archaeological evidence, is that when the Europeans first arrived back, you know, in the 15th century on the East Coast, if you could fly straight to the Great Plains at that point, there were very few people up on the Great Plains. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of tribes that were kind of forced there because they couldn't settle anywhere else. And they lived in teepees. They'd already invented the teepee. They'd already come up with what is actually the perfect shelter for anyone who has to live in an environment like that. For starters, it's made out of the local material, the only material local to you. So you have to go slightly into the foothills of the Rockies to find the poles. They've got a thing called a lodgepole pine over there, which is nice and straight and easy to cut. So they used to build their lodges. That's what they call teepees over there. They used to build their lodges out of the lodgepole pine. Then you've got the canvas itself. It's not made out of canvas as it is these days. It used to be made out of buffalo hide, which is the best sheet material and the most abundant sheet material on the Great Plains. And then all the other things, they used to hold them down with big stones. They had bone latches to close the door, and they used pelt as well to line the teepees. So it's all made out of local materials, which is your first point. But the other thing is that it's perfect for nomads. If you're going to be a buffalo hunter, you have to be able to move, because the herds move. So if you're going to survive on them year-round, you've got to drift with them. And consequently, you can have something that you can take with you. And teepees are amazing. The proper teepees that you find in North America, you can collapse them. I mean, they're huge things, but you can collapse them and put them up again in about half an hour. Not only that, but you can also arrange them so that you can transport them easily. You actually create them that they will convert into a sledge, and you can drag it along. It doesn't have wheels. Nobody invented the wheel in North America. They inherited it from the Europeans. But before wheels, what they did was they just dragged their teepees along the Great Plains. And in fact, you can still find the drag marks on the plains where they used to drag these teepees from one season to another. So teepees are a brilliant solution to life on the plains.
Everyone will be familiar with Darwin and the Galapagos Islands, and the Galapagos Islands being an archipelago, which is, you know, somewhere wherein the, you know, with the finches and whatever, the evolution was obviously enacted. And you're searching for a cultural Galapagos as you're looking around the plains Indians. And obviously one way in which that is enacted is the fact that they are geographically distinct from each other. Obviously, there's vast differences of the plains. But another example that you look at specifically in the book is that of language. So let's look at the language of the Plains Indians as an example of cultural evolution and as an example of a means by which they were nearby but separate.
Yeah, so my aim really was to, if I was trying to investigate whether ideas evolve like living things, what I wanted was that parallel with Darwin's Galapagos, as you say. So I had to start thinking, back in England, I was thinking, what would be an archipelago of islands in the cultural sphere, in the newer sphere? And my solution was, really, that an island in the cultural world would be any slightly isolated, not completely isolated, but any slightly isolated group of human minds. Because a group of human minds that kept themselves to themselves could hold an idea, and it would be sort of isolated on an island. And tribes are an ideal example, an easy example to think up, of a group of people that keep themselves to themselves. And up until very recently, I mean, you can go to Papua New Guinea and you can find tribes today, but in a sort of cheaper airfare, and also a place where, from a cultural perspective, would be less of a voyage to alien life, if you like.
Yeah, one way you can stay in nice motels, by the way, as well.
Okay, fair enough. I have actually been to Papua New Guinea, and this is probably a better option. Yeah, you're right. And it's got good roads, is America. Up until very recently, the Great Plains Indians were very distinct cultural identities of particular tribes who didn't mix with each other, let alone with the Westerners. Mm-hmm. Of course, still nowadays, they've got very proud traditions and their culture is well protected. But it wasn't so long ago where they were completely detached, if you like, as a group of islands scattered over the plains themselves, which is like an ocean in a certain sense. So it seemed like a very good target. And what you find is that the geography of this place, the geography of this archipelago, is complicated because it's actually physically geographical as well, because, as you say, because their tribes are found in particular locations on the Great Plains. But also there are kind of clusters of islands located by things like language. And language is a great tool for anyone looking at cultural history, because if groups of people have languages that are related, and there's so many different ways of deciding how closely languages are related these days. As historical linguists have spent careers trying to work out exactly how closely, say, Crow and Sioux language are related. They can date these things now. It's a really good tool for me, because I wanted to find out roughly, you know, map out the history of Plains Indians coming onto the plains, and you could find little clusters of islands amongst this archipelago and put together a geography. What you find is that Crow is distantly related to Sioux, that they probably split about 200-300 years ago, judging by the rate at which words have changed since then. Words have evolved, I suppose we could say, since then. And that gives you quite a nice method of working out the kind of family tree of Plains Indians, and as a consequence, you might expect or hypothesize the family tree of teepees as well.
I want to have a look at what happens when two new spheres clash up against each other. So obviously we all know what happened when the old world and the new world clashed on the plains in America. And let's talk about what happened to the ideas when two group of ideas clash. And of course, I guess if you're in the business of wiping out an indigenous population, I guess it helps to see not only the people but their culture as inferior to your own. But you would still expect that there would be some ideas of the Plains Indian culture that would survive into the new population. So what happens when two groups of ideas clash up?
Yeah. You've got to be really careful here because it's a very touchy subject, obviously. We're talking about history where lots and lots of generations have suffered. Certainly, cultures clash. There's no doubt about that. It's a cliche. And our history is effectively an account of clashing cultures. That's what the whole history of humanity is. So there's, you know, something afoot there. Something is going on. And a famous one is, of course, when the Europeans went to the New World, found this group of people who they would have thought of as primitive. In fact, they were spectacularly adapted to the places in which they lived. But as you know, and it's pretty apparent when you go there nowadays, and they're walking around, you know, the Native Americans are walking around in jeans and shirts and cowboy hats, that there's been a lot of admixture of ideas. You still find teepees. We find teepees in Glastonbury, actually. So there's been movement both ways of ideas. But you'd say that the dominant movement has been from the what we call the old world, the European civilization, the Western civilization, onto these endemic populations. And there is a parallel in biological evolution. Again, there's a parallel for all of these things, which is a hint in itself. And the parallel that I chose to use was when North America and South America, which were two distinct land masses up until fairly recently, came together at Panama, on the Isthmus of Panama. They joined, and there was this mixture of species. So a load of species went from the north down to the south, and a load of species went from the south up into the north. But actually, if you look at what survived that clash, South America is riddled with North American species, but there are very few South American species up in North America. It didn't survive. They didn't survive because, and this is how biologists would say it, the selective environment in South America was not as competitive as the selective environment in North America. So you could say that the North American animals had a harder life, basically, and historically it had millions of years of a tougher life where they're up against greater competition. And that tough life actually honed more advanced species of cat, of bird, of insectivore, of insect even. They're all clashing the whole time, and evolution was, if you like, at a faster pace in that North American continent. The reason it was is because North America was joined to the whole of the old world. So actually, if you're a species living in North America, you've got to put up with the invasions of species that were living across Eurasia and also all the way down into Africa as well. So it was an arena that was on a much bigger scale in South America. And I think there's a similarity between the clash of the old world and the new in cultural terms as well. That what you had were ideas that had spent thousands of years trying to survive, because that's the way we're interpreting the lives of ideas. They're trying to survive. They have to adapt to survive, otherwise they go extinct. It's adapt or die. And they've been operating in the larger theatre of Europe, Asia, the big civilizations that we know of, the Middle East even, and Africa as well. And as we know, the Europeans, when they went over in 1492, they had incredible technologies like enormous ships with huge canvas sails and techniques of navigating across vast ocean spaces and guns and cures for diseases and things like this. And they arrived on the east coast of America and they found people that in which that cultural environment had just not been there. The population densities weren't so great. Their ideas hadn't had to go through that kind of past evolution. And just like the South American animals, they suffered as a result of it. And a lot of those ideas became either rare and sort of had to be preserved, I suppose, actively, or became extinct. And there's a lot of the Indians talk about the old way, which is their buffalo hunting days. And there are a lot of ideas from the old way that nobody remembers anymore. They've gone extinct.
Just to finish off then, I want to perhaps look at how looking at cultural ideas in the world through these goggles of Darwinian evolution helps us understand ourselves. And I guess we touched on this in the discussion earlier about the concept of the genius, but one of the things that Darwin did, obviously, you know, in sort of destabilising God as the creator of the world and as the idea that we have some sort of meaning in our lives. And then, you know, a few weeks ago we had the psychologist Bruce Hood on the show and we were talking about the concept of free will and how that probably doesn't exist. And now you're telling me that none of the ideas I have could be original or even can be my own ideas. Does this idea not take away even more control of our lives?
Yeah, on the face of it, it's pretty nihilistic, actually. It's not much fun. And it is exactly as you say. It's a parallel with the impact that Darwin had on the world. And everyone thought the world was this marvellous place built by a super, you know, creator. And Darwin comes along and says, no, that's me. it actually could happen automatically. And what we're saying here with this is that, you know, this incredible phenomenon that is humanity and all these amazing ideas that we've collected over time, that's all happened automatically, perhaps. And we didn't have much to do with it, really. We were just hosts. You know, welcome hosts, I suppose, and we were good hosts, but it's on autopilot. Cultural evolution is on autopilot, same as biological evolution. And that takes quite a lot away from us, really, and it's quite it's a bit underwhelming, really, when you think about it. In that sense, I'd like to think that we can go past that. I think, first of all, with the perspective, I'm not a believer in a super creator, so I'm a Darwinian through and through, but it doesn't mean that I think the natural world isn't amazing. It is amazing. And the fact that there's no mind behind it all, in my opinion, makes it even more amazing, actually, that it's come together like this without any thought. And likewise, you can look at humanity and say, well, this is absolutely astonishing that this has come about because of this incredible melee between ideas and this sort of competition over many, many generations, survival of some and the extinction of others. And we end up with this astonishing wealth, this richness of idea species all competing together. So I think there is a lot of value to be had in it. And also there's the extra opportunity, I suppose. If we stand back and see this world of human thought in this way, we can actually say, hang on, now we get this and we see how, in a way, how detached we are from it. We ought to be a little bit more critical about the ideas that we host collectively. Maybe we should say, hang on a minute, let's not. These ideas, the only reason they're in the game, if you like, is for their own good. It's a selfish thing. You know, there's plenty of ideas around the planet that are not healthy for human beings, that we, you know, a lot of people spend a lot of time engaged with, kill for even. That's not healthy for us. It may do the idea a lot of good, and the idea itself may become strong and powerful, and there may be lots of examples of it, and it may be thriving, but it doesn't mean to say it's good for the humans that are hosting it. And perhaps if we take this perspective and look at it objectively, we could say, hang on, let's really think about what ideas we want to encourage and promote and host. And the other ideas, maybe we should put them aside somewhere for prosperity, keep them in the record, but let's not engage with them. And that's sort of active, it's sort of like active conservation, but it's with ideas rather than animals and plants. That could be a really worthwhile project for us, I think.
That's a really great thought to take us into the weekend. So I've been talking to Johnny Hughes, and we've been talking about his book On the Origin of Teepees, Why Some Ideas Spread While Others Go Extinct. It's out now from One World Books. Johnny, thanks for talking to Little Atoms tonight.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.